This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
On the 20th of July 2022, the Malaysian Parliament passed the long-awaited Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill. But did you know that the first draft of the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill was penned 22 years ago? I'm Darshan Johan and this is Today I Learned. On this episode of Today I Learned, we are going to be taking a look at the origins of the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill and the significance of it finally being passed in Parliament. But first, what exactly is sexual harassment? The newly passed bill defines sexual harassment as any unwanted act of sexual nature in whatever form, be it verbal, non-verbal, visual, a signal, or physical, which is targeted to an individual that reasonably causes offence, insults, or threatens their well-being. Now, keep this in mind because I will circle back to the definition later. Now, sexual harassment is a huge problem in Malaysia. According to a 2020 survey of 1,000 Malaysian women, 62% have experienced workplace sexual harassment. In a separate survey by YouGov, it is found that sexual harassment happens to 35% of women and 17% of men in Malaysia. So, to be clear, while women represent a majority of the survivors or victims of sexual harassment, it is an issue that cuts across genders. Despite it being a haunting issue, prior to last week, victims of sexual harassment had very few legal avenues within the frameworks of existing laws. So here's what Natasha Dandavati, the head of campaigns at the Women's Aid Organization, had to say when we spoke to her a couple of years ago.
So we do currently have some laws that protect against sexual harassment, but they don't go far enough. So we have provisions in the Employment Act, which protect against sexual harassment between employers and employees. But of course, that leaves out many different contexts of sexual harassment, from educational institutions to volunteers with organizations to religious institutions to simply harassment on the street. So right now, there is not any comprehensive law that covers all those different contexts of harassment. Besides the Employment Act, we also have the tort of sexual harassment. Now, anybody can bring a case in civil court or based on the tort of sexual harassment. But the issue with that is the court process is expensive. It's lengthy. It's very public. So a lot of survivors don't want to go through that process. And then finally, we also have certain provisions in the penal code, which address some forms of sexual harassment. And a lot of times survivors really don't want to go to the police when they experience harassment. And there's a variety of reasons for that. It could be embarrassment, trauma. You know, they're not looking for the harasser to get punished criminally. They're really just looking for an apology or some other form of redress. And so, you know, the criminal option is really not always the best way to address sexual harassment. So as mentioned, even though we do have these existing protections, they just don't go far enough and they don't ensure redress for survivors in a way that's not expensive and not time consuming and burdensome.
The Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill is definitely something we needed, but that need increased tenfold during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdowns.
So since the start of the pandemic, we've seen a sharp rise in gender-based violence, and that's been both in the physical realm as well as online. So WAO ourselves have seen a 3.5 times increase in inquiries to our telephone and WhatsApp hotline. And other NGOs such as AWAM have also received a sharp increase in calls. And in the case of AWAM, 23% of calls to their helpline were actually sexual harassment cases. So with that continued rise, there's definitely a pressing need to have legislation in place to address sexual harassment. And additionally, another of the results of the pandemic has been the increase of the unpaid care burden on women. And so with that, more women have been forced to try to juggle personal and professional responsibilities. And that's actually caused some women to be forced out of the workforce altogether. So to address the additional barriers that remain in the workforce for those women who are continuing to work. It's critical that we have sexual harassment legislation in place to ensure that more women are not being pushed out as a result of sexual harassment and other forms of gender-based violence.
In a separate interview, Nisha Sabanayagam, who's the Program and Operations Manager of the All Women's Action Society, also known as AWAM, spoke to us about the rise in online sexual harassment during the various lockdowns. Because according to a press statement by AWAM in 2020, about 40% of sexual harassment complaints received by the organization during the MCO are incidences of online sexual harassment.
Universally, when there are crises such as pandemics like this, the situation tends to exacerbate the vulnerability of women and girls. And as a result, incidences of gender-based violence or GBV also rises. So in line with your question specifically to the case of online sexual harassment increasing during the MCO, it's a natural trend. The second thing is it's also quite straightforward. More people are at home. More people are spending time in front of the computers. Therefore, perpetrators have more time on their hands. They're getting less stimulation from the outside world. And thus, there is a tendency to sexually harass people online, even more so than usual. Another thing is also with the MCO, you know, people call it the new normal, right? Mm-hmm. And this has created new spaces and new scenarios. And these new spaces and new scenarios actually set up a conducive platform for online sexual harassment. For example, young women who are returning home from universities abroad now have to stay in a quarantine center on their own without their support system, without their families close at hand. And this actually makes them puts them in a more vulnerable situation. And in quarantine centers, young women, all inhabitants of the quarantine centers are supposed to register and give their phone numbers and personal details during registration. And this information then becomes available to the staff of the quarantine centers. And all you need is just one bad apple to take advantage of the phone numbers available to him or her, and they start sending unsavory WhatsApp messages or unsavory pictures over WhatsApp. And then there's another new situation that's popping up online, which is online forums and online webinars. So the forums are generally held for awareness raising, and we also see quite a number of senior public figures or newsmakers on them. These open forums often come hand in hand with an open comment section, mm-hmm. rightly so, because you want the public to engage better with the discussion. But the flip side of all this openness is that now a female persona online at some point in time becomes a perfect target for an online perpetrator, because there is a ready audience and there is a ready platform and a ready channel available for them to sexually harass their victims online. We have heard of harassment, online sexual harassment happening on Twitter, usually in the form of some kind of Twitter messaging that is very nasty towards women or down-degrading women. We've also had online sexual harassment not specifically addressed to one woman, but to women in general on TikTok, where a boy recorded a message saying that, you know, women who do not cover themselves up properly deserve to be raped. We've also received one or two complaints on online sexual harassment on Facebook. And the most recent one, which made the news, was the state assembly persons, YB Jamalia and YB Lim Yiwei, receiving rape threats on FB when they had an online forum. The MCO as a whole tends to bring a general sense of malaise for most of us because we're stuck indoors. And most of us are not at our best mentally. On top of that, there's another factor. We are also taught as women to feel shame when sexual violence is inflicted upon us. So being sexually harassed online in non-MCO situations during pre-MCO days in itself already brings a huge amount of shame because it happens on a public platform. It also causes anxiety, it causes stress, it causes depression. So imagine being sexually harassed online during the MCO. This is like double jeopardy, right? The anxiety, the stress, the depression times two. Because you're alone, you're not able to go out, you can't reach out to your friends or your family for face-to-face support as you normally would do during pre-MCO days. So I would say that the impacts, they're quite specific in the sense that they cause a lot of shame, they cause a lot of anxiety, they cause stress, they cause depression, but they are amplified during the MCO period.
As a whole, the lack of laws specifically addressing sexual harassment made it incredibly challenging for victims and survivors to speak up. And even if they did, the process is rarely favourable to the victim or survivor. Take Ayn Hosniza, for example. Last April, Ayn Hosniza, who was then a 17-year-old student, took to TikTok to complain about a teacher at her school who had so-called joked about rape in front of the class. She never named the teacher publicly, yet the teacher has sued her for defamation, and she's now entangled in a bunch of court trials. If it sounds absolutely mind-blowing and ridiculous, know that this is just one example of a high-profile case. There are far more stories like this that go unheard. Alright, we do need to go for a very quick break. After the break, we continue our deep dive into the anti-sexual harassment bill. Keep here on Today I Learned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Today I Learned. I'm Dashran Johan, and today we are doing a deep dive into the anti-sexual harassment bill and the long journey women's rights groups in Malaysia have gone on to get this bill passed in Parliament. So, as we know, sexual harassment isn't a novel issue, but something that has been plaguing our patriarchal society for a very long time. In fact, in Malaysia, the first anti-sexual harassment bill was tabled by JAG, which is the Joint Action Group for Gender Equality, a whopping 22 years ago. One of the key figures behind the movement to push for the anti-sexual harassment bill is 67-year-old Betty Yeo. When I caught up with her previously, she spoke about the origins of the bill.
It came after the Domestic Violence Act was passed. Mm. Then we started to work on it. And credit must go to Zarizana. Zarizana is a lawyer by profession, and she was then, I think, the chairperson of the Women Crisis Centre. At that time, the Penang organisation was called Women Crisis Centre, but now the name is changed to Women Centre for Change. Yeah. So she in Penang, we in KL, Awam, and what Awam and Empower, the Women's Development Collective. So what started as a draft by all of us, drafted by Zarizana, needs to be fine-tuned.
Right.
So it left myself and another colleague of mine, Siu Ching. We had to do this, and last time got no email that we can just so easily, you know, I make changes, it's now in the drive, you go and make a look at it. Last time we literally took a drive, okay?
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't a car drive, it was a bus drive. All right.
Okay.
So Siu Ching and I will be on the bus to Penang, where Zarizana is, and we will be looking at the draft. And that's where I always remember I learned the term vicarious liability. Yeah. So this is how, because Siu Ching is a lawyer by background.
Okay.
She has legal background. Yeah. Mm. So as we go through, she will explain terms. And when I ask, what is this? She will explain. So we did all this on the way to Penang. And bus ride is not so short, like 1 hour, it's like five hours at least, yeah? So we can learn a lot of things in that five-hour class. So when we reach there, we work with Zarizana. We bunk in with her in her house. And that's how, because NGO got no money. We have to save every cent. You can't just fly there. You just take a bus, go there, do all this, and then take a bus home. So these are the interesting, memorable things that till now you don't forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And one thing about the Joint Action Group is, even though we do things by a certain organization, every organization has input. So whoever who are partners in the Joint Action Group then gave our input, our thoughts, everything, and then the few of us would streamline it properly. So that was the initial one. So after handing it in 2002, we had another roundtable meeting where a lot of overseas countries' representative came. Some of them already have the Sexual Harassment Act in their own countries. So we input further into this bill of ours. But of course, sitting between the Ministry of Human Resource and Ministry of Women, it goes ding dong until it lapsed 20 years, almost 20 years, about 18 or 19 years. Then we get to say, redraft it. So then, of course, it fell back on our seat to look at how to redraft it. And at that point of time, we have a young group of women. They are called the Young Women Making Change, their group, also trying to make changes, bringing about a law on sexual harassment. So we invited them together and we all worked together, including the lawyers from the AWL, because they person like me, I can only give some input from the past till now. And then these young lawyers, they now with the computer can do, you know, research everywhere. And with their own legal background, contributed much to the current draft that we did. So on the surface, the most resistant group of people towards the act we can see is the Malaysian Employers Federation. They have their concerns. They are afraid that we don't know what they are afraid of. But that's one of it. Another area, this is my own opinion. Mm-hmm. It could be that our culture in our society is so used to having women being submissive, you know. And it's almost became a culture to them, to some people, to tease women, to make sexist comments. You know, this rape culture happens in our society. They make a joke of rape. They talk about things in a sexist manner, like poor Ayn. So all this is something that will be taken away, and that's their fear. Mm-hmm. All this norm that they are so used to is going to be changed. Yeah, but of course, day to day, if these things happen, you can still like tahan. I can't put it in English, but tahan it a bit. But yeah. If this happens in the workplace, how is it going to impact on people? It has tremendous mental, affects your mental, affects your physical, and affects the remuneration that you earn if you don't go and do your job. Yeah. So actually, internationally, countries, companies are all changing. They're accepting the International Convention 190 under the ILO, International Labour Organization, which places a lot of effort and concern on how an organization is run, how they must provide certain good governance to make sure that they address the issue of sexual harassment at the workplace. What is the root cause? What can you put in place to support those who need to make a report on cases? These people shouldn't face retaliation. You know, you need to have policies. You need to have reporting mechanism. You need to have support for the people who face sexual harassment, counseling, etc. So when you do not accept that responsibility as a provider of work, you are already preventing all these benefits or all these rights to your workers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is why we say that it is not something new. And if people are worried that, oh, if a company is known to have sexual harassment, it will be bad if you do not take an effort to clamp the sexual harassment. Exactly. But if your organization does all the preventive work, do all the policies, do all the things that you need to do, people will make you and say, oh, you are such a good company. You're doing fantastic job. So I don't see why companies are afraid of sexual harassment law being passed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would be so good if they just embrace it and show them that we are such good employers. And once the law is there, people will follow, hopefully. Yeah, mm-hmm. Hopefully.
So this has been a long journey. Real progress was made during the Pakatan Harapan administration. And while Langkah Sheraton did the real things, it is great that the subsequent administrations did actually follow through on the bill. At long last, this anti-sexual harassment bill was passed. One of the most important aspects of this new bill is the inclusion of a tribunal, which is an alternative platform for the complainants who were victims and survivors of sexual harassment to lodge complaints and seek redress. But how exactly will it work? Here's what Janelle Tan, Information and Communications Officer at the All Women Action Society, had to say.
Well, basically, the reason why the tribunal is being set up through the bill is because the bill intends to provide a redress mechanism that is affordable, accessible, and basically safe for the survivors. The tribunal is being basically included in the bill in order to take into account the various barriers that were already experienced by current and previous survivors, you know, when pursuing, for example, civil court cases under the tort of sexual harassment, which I'm sure we all know there's no privacy. It's very expensive because you need to hire lawyers, right? So the tribunal, if we were to go by the bill, anyone can file a complaint for individual cases between perpetrators and survivors that can be brought to the tribunal. And it looks like it's as simple as lodging a complaint via quotation marks, a prescribed form at a certain fee. These details, you know, the nitty-gritty, how much it will cost, where can you find this form? Is it physical? Is it online? What languages can you use to file? What's the processing time? All these things, I think we can look forward to seeing these being covered. With regards to legal representation, generally by the bill, it's not allowed except when the tribunal determines that the case involves complex legal issues. So that's when legal representation is allowed. And all hearings, it was explicitly mentioned as well in the bill that it's closed to the public. So it protects the survivor's privacy. As for the tribunal's function, generally it's to hear and determine any complaints of sexual harassment that they have received. I think it'll be familiar to some in the corporate world with regards to the industrial court. So it essentially functions in a very similar manner. It's just that the difference is that this one is just purely focused on sexual harassment cases. As for the sitting, at least as dictated by the bill, there will be 3 panel members in any one sitting. And it's clearly specified that any panel sitting should comprise of at least one woman. So
right.
There's at least some safeguard when it comes to the representation of women in hearing, determining complaints when it comes to sexual harassment cases. And with regards to awards, I'm pretty sure the public will be interested as to what are the range of awards, what's the range of awards that's provided under the bill. So one is for sure compensation or damages, but the max is $250,000. Other forms include statement of apology, whether it's directly to the survivor, or let's say if there are cases where sexual harassment is being committed in public, for example, let's say by politicians, you know, certain sexist remarks, then the statement apology can be ordered by the tribunal to be issued publicly. As for whether you need to file a police report in order to lodge a complaint to the tribunal, no, it's actually independent. So even if you did not file a police report beforehand, you can go straight to the tribunal and lodge a complaint.
While we rejoice, it's also important to note that the current bill is not flawless. Some tweaks were made to the bill proposed by civil society. Earlier, I spoke to Daniela Zulkifli. She's the vice president of the Association of Women Lawyers, who's also a part of JAG. She broke down what's lacking in the current bill and how it can be improved.
Along the way, we've also done a lot of revisions. And through those revisions, especially in 2017 onwards, myself came in and a few others, we had looked at several different precedents and, you know, different examples from other jurisdictions and how it had, you know, how they have been used. We also looked at existing law. So, you know, when we drafted the ASH bill, at least in the original draft, we wanted a bit more of a comprehensive bill. And that includes an expanded definition of what sexual harassment is. So currently, the definition of sexual harassment in the bill does not cover instances of sexual harassment that occurs within, an environment that is hostile. And I think that is quite an important thing that we want to add. So the language that we had proposed was actually that it creates an intimidating, offensive, or hostile environment. So that's the first one. The second one is that we wanted to have a protection against victimization. So that is currently missing. The third one is that we wanted an obligation or a positive duty for organizations. And organizations here means, like, you know, whether it's a public or private institution, whether it's a school or a hotel or, you know, F&B service, or even, you know, so-called nasi lemak salad, which is apparently a very popular analogy. We want these organizations or institutions to prevent and address sexual harassment, to take reasonable steps to do so. And it's quite interesting, actually, that, you know, in one of the amendments that was, you know, that was made during the parliamentary debate, was that the preamble was amended to include language on prevention. But prevention has not been substantially addressed in the bill itself, right? The other thing that we wanted was also a monitoring committee to oversee the implementation of the bill. The minister had actually made this commitment during her speech itself. And I think we're really looking forward to that, because currently there is none to actually, you know, basically be like a an alternative or a check and balance to the administrator role.
The question is, why exactly are the things that are lacking important? Why do we need it?
Firstly, on the definition of harassment. So what we're trying to address here is that sexual harassment is not necessarily directed at a particular individual. It can also be made in the presence of like a group of people or people who are, you know, happen to be in a particular area. The current definition can be made clearer so that it covers the sort of situations where, like, let's say, you know, maybe a perpetrator is masturbating in public, for example, right? So it's not necessarily directed at a particular person, but to people who are basically roaming around that area. And I think we've seen a lot of these incidents, right? And unfortunately, it happens in public places, in bus stops and so on and so forth. And it's important for us to actually expand that definition to enable, you know, coverage in that sort of instance. Then we also want to protect survivors from retaliation. This is why we wanted to add that provision on victimization. Because a lot of times people are afraid to speak up, right? And there's no mechanism for them to then turn to, like, let's say if I make a report and then, you know, another action is taken against me, for example. And I think we've seen examples in you know, some of the more recent cases, like let's say Ain Husnisa, where she was actually sued for defamation. And I think that would actually provide a bit more of if we have a protection against victimization, that would give people a bit more of a courage to actually say, you know, I have been sexually harassed, so that you can speak up without that fear of intimidation or threat.
Right.
Then the third one is, you know, this, you know, duty and or organizational duties, as we call it. We want that so that we can inculcate a culture of zero tolerance towards sexual harassment. And what that means is that the organization or institution needs to make known that sexual harassment is unacceptable. Make sure that people know what sexual harassment is and what people can do or go to, what recourse or remedy are available to them. Because a lot of times we find that sexual harassment occurs in environments or culture where it is enabled, where perpetrators feel that they have the power to do something without action, you know, being taken against them, or where, you know, such a behavior is normalized. And then the monitoring committee is essentially sort of like a check and balance to the administrator to ensure that the intent of the act is actually implemented, especially in relation to the tribunal, and as well as, you know, assisting in, like, you know, drafting and regulations or guidelines to supplement the act. And, you know, this is important because you want people who actually have experience in sexual harassment issues, in gender equality issues, in sexual violence issues. You know, you want to have that sort of panel of a diverse and independent experts who who are familiar with what we are looking at.
There's also no denying that the definition of sexual harassment in the bill is purposely left broad enough to cover the varying nature of sexual harassment. It is a very nuanced issue. However, broad definitions can be subject to abuse. Recently in Parliament, Perikatan Nasional MP Abdul Latif Abdul Rahman asked if whether wearing sexually provocative or inappropriate clothes was a sexual harassment offence. To that, Women, Family and Community Development Minister Rina Mohammad Harun responded by saying that, and I quote, wearing provocative attire can be sexual harassment if it meets the definition of the bill. While that can be a scary thought, there is a purpose for the phrasing of the definition. Janelle Tan broke it down for me.
So this one's actually a very nuanced aspect that needs to be taken into account. From what I can see, what YB Rina is trying to say is the part about dressing or not dressing being considered sexual harassment. The one example that I can think of would be flashing, where you know you show your private parts to people in public. So that's a very clear-cut case of gestural or nonverbal sexual harassment, which would align with the definition that you have just elaborated, which would be unwanted, sexual, reasonably offensive or humiliating, and in some cases threat to someone's well-being. So flashing in this case would fulfill the aspects that I've just highlighted in the definition. But then again, if some people were to interpret it in a different way, then it goes off in a very different direction and a very wrongful one. Because like when it is not interpreted or understood correctly, what YB Rina Harun was saying, it can be potential grounds for abuse, where when in our society, we already see prevalent victim blaming of sexual harassment survivors on the basis of what they wear. By taking what YB Rina Harun said literally without understanding the context, one, perpetuates victim blaming. Two, I don't know if some people actually remember, but back in 2019 and even 2013, a couple of MPs actually in Parliament brought up things like proposing a sexual harassment act to protect men from blah, blah, blah. Or even in 2013, indecent culture of women wearing short pants, so you need to have a law to prevent women from wearing indecent clothing to curb sexual crimes. So you can see if members of Parliament already have this, certain members of Parliament already have such preconceptions, what's more, the public, and even worse, influential figures, be it in politics, be it in the criminal justice or law enforcement systems, to perpetuate such narratives that would impede sexual harassment survivors from coming forward. So by misinterpreting what YB Rina Harun said, it essentially would further perpetuate the narratives that we don't want to perpetuate. Last but not least, it would obscure the entire fact where sexual harassment is not about how you dress. I think YB Hanayo has specified very, very clearly in this. But rather, sexual harassment is, if permit me in being more technical, a sociocultural construction of power relationships that operate on the basis of gender and in some cases sexuality. So when you deviate from that reality, you're essentially ignoring all the factors, the currents that have been teaching men, women, boys, girls at a young age. Basically, the sexualization of women's and girls' bodies. There are certain forms of sexual harassment which, to some extent, would involve not dressing or dressing in a provocative manner that's very unwanted, and it fits sexual harassment. But on the other hand, it's also important to bear in mind that we should not stray into victim blaming and other narratives. And it's also important that for the upcoming tribunal members that are being appointed, that they actually are aware of these nuances and they actually don't end up perpetuating these narratives when they hear and determine complaints.
So, yes, the anti-sexual harassment bill in its current form is far from perfect, and we should continue to push our members of parliament to improve upon it. However, even in its current form, the anti-sexual harassment bill is certainly a huge step towards a more progressive and inclusive Malaysia. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Today I Learned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.